League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock market commenter Paul Scott to talk all things small cap. So welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Paul. Hello, everyone. Good to be back.
Yeah, well, we were just having a bit of a laugh before we started because I was expecting Paul to put a number on his chest there. So he'd be on that sort of like line, the police lineup. Anyway, you're definitely not guilty. We'll get you that. Okay, but you were absolutely spot on last week when you predicted we were going to get a deluge of training updates. And I think you've been working pretty feverishly over the last four or five days. I've seen all the output, so I'll tip my hat to that. I'm glad I'm not doing what you're doing. But we've also had... we've had softer than expected CPI on both sides of the Atlantic and very fortunately, the end of the Gaza-Israel war seems to be a ceasefire anyway. But so putting all that together, what's your sort of like your view of the markets? Does it mean anything? We've had the news this week at all, just big picture wise.
Big picture wise, I don't honestly think obviously we're all delighted that there's been a ceasefire, but I don't think that really actually directly affects my space in the small and mid cap space. So that, I think, for market moving stuff, I've disregarded. Yeah, slightly lower than expected inflation prints in the US and America, UK and America, couldn't have come up with more perfect timing, could they? We had this sort of what looked like some sort of, the bond markets testing the highs of US and UK government bond yields, which both peaked at around 4.9%. I mean, the UK is completely in lockstep on a day-by-day basis with the US. And it's been interesting to watch. But personally, I've largely disregarded it, you know, because these things just can change on a sixpence. So I don't think it should be driving my personal investing decisions. But how about you, Paul? Have you made any adjustments or trimmed?
No, I haven't made any adjustments. It's a nice relief, isn't it, to do a sort of take some of the heat out of the yield curve. And it's come down, I think, the 10-year in the UK by about 30 basis points, which actually is quite a lot. So
it's a vertical move down basically in 3 days, isn't it, to 4.6 or slightly below maybe. Yeah, I think we can all breathe a sigh of relief to a certain extent, at least in the short term. I think the markets did get a bit carried away with this whole issue, actually. So, it's been welcome relief for us in the last Wednesday, Thursday and Friday this week, for sure.
Yeah, well, we'll come on to that with how it impacts certain stocks, but it's good for interest rate sensitive areas and sectors like house builders and people like that. Anybody who generates sort of has to pay interest and debt borrowers and stuff. Okay, if anybody wants to ask Paul any questions, please put them into the chat bot. Well, surprise, surprise, what's top of the agenda today is IG Design, which had a bit of a shocker this morning with its profit statement. I mean, it makes all things Christmas cracker, Christmas cards and Christmas greetings. And you guessed it, it had a bad Christmas. So the shares are down. I shouldn't laugh. I should have the shares are down more than 50%. I'm really sorry for, you know, investors who have got caught on the other side of this. It's a painful process. But how have you sort of interpreted it? It was something totally left field, actually.
Well, it was and it wasn't. I mean, I didn't see this coming. I think the first thing when you see a profit, I mean, it's not one I hold personally, but I've obviously covered it for my Substack readers today. It was in the premium section, but seeing as it's you, I'll disregard that. It was an absolute disaster. I put my comment on it out at 10 to 8 and said, look, this share, this is a disaster. This share is going to drop at least 50% today. My take on it, you know, you've got to get rid of the emotion and look at this logically. Should we have seen this coming? And I think, well, we did to a certain extent, because the company put out updates in both October and November saying that trading was soft. So there was basically a soft profit warning on, I think it was the 29th of November or thereabouts, where they said they were at the bottom end of expectations. And we knew that H1 had been soft. They'd already put out poor numbers for that. And Canaccord referred to it as a challenging first half, used their word. So there was existing announcements, you know, saying that they were struggling. But why wasn't I waving the red flags on this? I'm afraid because I believed management's reassurances. So each time there was some bad news over the last 3 or 4 months, they talked about, you know, the recovery steps they were taking and now, it's easy to have hindsight, but I don't think people who were long with this share should beat themselves up too much, actually, because they took at each point in September, October, November, when the bad news did come out, the shares looked dirt cheap and brokers were saying, you know, look, earnings forecasts have only been trimmed a little bit and the company's talking about recovery and blah, blah, blah. So it was actually quite a rational thing, I think, to own this share. And then just out of the blue today comes news that it's not going to make $32 million operating profit. It's going to make nothing. Now, why such a big gap? Well, actually, half of it, I think, was included in that number, is a bad debt write-off. So they've had some big customers in the US go bust. Now, nobody can predict that. I don't think investors should beat yourselves up over the fact that you didn't know that they were going to take a $15 million hit from bad debts. I mean, that is, the finance department should have insured the receivables book, or at least got someone like you to analyze the balance, or me to look at the balance sheets of the customers and say, look, you shouldn't be supplying these guys because they're about to go into chapter 11. So deficiencies in the finance department, very definitely there. And I don't think we can believe anything management say now. I think their credibility is gone. So, but the interesting thing on the stock, just to quickly wrap this up, is that it's now a special situation. So what you've got is you've got nearly 100 million shares in issue. So at 59 or 60p thereabouts, it's only 60 million quid market cap. Yeah. The last balance sheet had net tangible asset value of over £200 million. I've converted it, but it was nearly $300 million. So you've got immense net tangible asset value there, which is mountains of working capital. And when they have net cash, they did say they're currently net cash, but they use a lot of bank borrowings at the peak season to fund their inventory and receivables build up, and banks don't mind lending that in that way, but it certainly brings into question the bank covenants. Now, are they going to be breached? You know, but that's not an immediate problem. This business is now, you know, is worth more if it ceases trading than if it carries on trading. So, but the trouble is, it's got $60-70 million lease liabilities. It employs lots of people, which obviously costs money to get rid of. So I think it's messy, even though you have got, on paper, colossal asset backing. So I think anyone buying it today is either a delusional average downer, just never buy on a profit warning averaging down. It's nearly always a mistake, I find. Or there are people of special situations buyers who's saying, well, this is now an asset breakup, shutting down type play. So anyway, over to you, Paul. Give me your opinion.
Yeah, I mean, you're the expert, no doubt about it. It certainly came as a surprise to me because the US consumer have been doing pretty well. I mean, you've seen that. Yeah. Christmas sales in the States were good. We've had decent, inflation's not negative. And there's been plenty of spend in sort of shopping malls. So these guys have lost a lot of market share. And the key question to me would be, is that permanent dilution? Is it the channel strategy, or is it just effectively becoming far more competitive in the actual whole space and they're losing market share? And until I didn't see that at all in the statement why they were actually, what was actually at the front end had actually seen it. But you're right, when it comes to just genuine sort of like asset balance sheet backing, then if you look at it, net tangible assets, then if you assume that they can collect most of that, clearly the bad debt they won't be able to, but if you assume that they can collect at least 80%, then they're probably trading at around about 30-40% of net tangible book, and therefore you're going to get a better result. But it's one for the brave, I think, if you're going to head into it. And but what you've just said, if we were a holder, if I was holding, I probably wouldn't sell actually on the other side of it.
No, same. I think you've taken the hit. And it's now a special situation. It's not about what the PE is going to be or anything like that, because it's, you know, the whole thing, the core business and the management have just gone out the window in terms of credibility. And somebody might bid for it as a sort of breakup situation. But, you know, you don't know what horrors are in the inventories figures or the receivables figures. That's the trouble. Mm. And it has got $20 million freehold property at cost. But yeah. I also found 20 million of creditors unrelated, which are called something like customer claims and provisions or something. Which might be sale or return. Yeah, I suspect they might well have sold some space. I think a balance sheet like that will be a can of worms. If a new management come in, which it probably needs, I think, they'll probably kitchen sink it and have huge balance sheet write-offs. And then it may not be as asset rich as we thought it was. Mm. But I think the core problem, and this is the reason I haven't invested in this share, irrespective of anything else, is it's applying, you know, wrapping paper, greetings cards, things like that. It just gets them made in China, dirt cheap. And then it sells them to customers mainly in America. Well, the big customers can do that directly with Chinese factories. Mm. This, to me, just seems an unnecessary intermediary with zero pricing power. So just when you look at it high level on the business model, no matter what management tell you about increasing operating margins to 5 or 10% or whatever, it doesn't pass the common sense test, which is that this business is not actually needed by customers that are big enough to place their own orders directly with the Chinese factories. And of course, you've got the tariffs issue, haven't you?
Mm. Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And I suppose one of the acid tests of whether it is a profitable special situation will be whether you get any insider buying, i.e. some of the big directors, or you get an activist shareholder who knows this one like the inside of his back of his hand and comes on and buys a 3-5%, because you could see that in the next. But I'm with you. I haven't got enough detail to make that call, and
I try to avoid investments now where we're having to make a leap of faith and we're just hoping that this or that will happen. Mm. I think I'm quite happy to watch from the sidelines. So what we want is our friends at Harwood popping up with a 10% stake, don't we? They've done the due diligence. So
Lawrence Hulse is another one, I think, at Onward Opportunities. Okay, and in the same sector, which is doing slightly better, is Card Factory, which does obviously greeting cards and gift wrapping paper, all kinds of stuff, but mainly on this side of the Atlantic in the UK, has actually just made a recent acquisition out in the States to extend its sort of distribution and sales outlets and stuff. But this one's done okay. It had positive like-for-likes. And what was your take on their recent trading update?
Very positive, because the issue with Card Factory, and I should disclose at this stage, I took a small opening position, just a starter size position, I think yesterday or the day before. So I am now talking my own book. But when I reported on the trading update, I didn't own any. I just listened back to my own podcast and convinced myself to buy some. But no, I mean, the main issue and the reason it did that enormous plunge from the £1.40 down to the 80p, which I think we've covered before, was that the H1 results were no good. Mm. They showed earnings down. But they said, we're still confident about the full year, January year end, this one, isn't it? And everybody, including me, scratched our heads and said, well, how are they going to make up this shortfall and still post growth in H2 to get to these? So a lot of us were saying, right, the full year forecast, which I think was for 14p or something, just don't look credible based on H1 was whatever, 3p or something. It was something like that. Anyway, they've just put out an update for the key Christmas period and said we've hit the numbers. I think they might have even been slightly ahead. So to me, risk reward is now better on this share than at any previous point on that graph. So for that reason, I think the PE now is the forward PE on, based on, the historical PE, based on what the numbers they've just reported, is only about 6.
Yeah,
and the dividends were reinstated not that long ago. And also you're getting about a 6% dividend yield. So when the PE and the dividend yield are the same, normally that's a declining, you know, cigar butt type stock, isn't it? But this isn't a cigar butt stock. It's showing very, very good turnaround under the new-ish management. I think everything stacks up. So I've totally dramatically improved my stance on it this week, because we now know those numbers are in the bag. So risk reward has just dramatically improved and the share price has barely reacted. So there's obviously still structural selling, isn't there, going on in the background from probably institutions who are having to meet redemptions and all the rest of it. So I'm only talking about the fundamentals of the company, which I think are very good, and it's very cheap. I think I valued this at, for my personal way of valuing shares, at between £1.40 and £1.80. So that means I see up double to 100% upside.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And I mean, the debt, you know, they're booking...
It's got a bit too much debt, but not massively. Anyway, sorry, over to you, Paul.
No, you're right. They're bucking the trend. I mean, one of their other sort of like, I mean, it's not in exactly the same type of operator, but it sells to the same sort of people. You know, you got B&M, basically. We talked about those last week.
Good.
But they had a slightly negative like for like. So these guys have actually outperformed even those guys, selling in a tough market to low income people. And you've got to tip your hat to them. You know, it's not easy on the high street, but they seem to be, if you get like for likes going, then you're going to be okay, aren't you? So
yeah, they're doing fine. And they did say that the core card like for like was something like 1.5% up, but the total was, I think, knocking on the door of 4%, because they're selling more gifts.
Yes.
So I think
the
management are very astute, I think, at Card Factory, and they know that they've got people in there buying cards. You can sell them all sorts of other bits and pieces if you get it right. And that strategy is working. I think it's a very good business, actually.
Yeah, 3.9% like for like. Okay, we've got a question from Ben Sharman. He's asking about JD Sports. Afternoon, chaps. Please, could we have your thoughts on JD Sports? Undervalued opportunity or business model is broken. What's your sort of thoughts there?
Disclosure on this one as well. I've bought this one this week as well.
Buying on the dip.
Buying on the dip, before the next dip, actually. I'm about 5% down. So I'm not a trader, so I'm not very good at timing my buys.
Yeah.
I cannot understand why this share has gone like that. Again, possibly something to do with tariff problems on its US business. Maybe people worrying about that. It's had a series of profit warnings, but they weren't major profit warnings at all. It went for a full price stance over Christmas rather than discounting, which meant that it had to slightly reduce the profit forecasts again, but it wasn't much at all. And, personally, if the demand isn't quite there that you want, you don't want to be cutting prices as well. I actually think they did the right thing maintaining a full price stance. And the long and the short of it is they're still reporting something like 900 million PBT. Well, that's only 10% short of what Next has indicated for the same year. And yet the valuation of JD Sports is about half the valuation of Next.
I think the PE was, last time I saw, was less than 10, isn't it, or something?
Oh, yeah, it's about six or seven. Yeah, it's very cheap. Yeah, I don't understand why JD Sports has sold down to this level. So it's one of those things where I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong with the business at all. You look at its long-term track record. This is a really successful growth company that's grown through acquisition. They really know what they're doing. It's a high-quality growth business, I think, and yet it's priced like a basket case. So I don't understand the valuation. You have got a strange ownership anomaly where I think, it's escaped my brain, but it's got a controlling shareholder with, I think, 51%. Maybe that puts people off a bit. I don't know. Because it's not going to be, you know, they would be able to block any takeover bid, but they might bid for it themselves if the valuation stays this low. So I think it's, to me, it looks irrationally cheap. I can't see anything wrong with it, but I might have missed something, Paul. So have you got? You don't have to agree with me. I mean, rip me to shreds if I've missed something obvious.
No, it looks pretty cheap. It's a big business. It's actually strategically quite a good position because it sells a lot of Nike kit, and Nike wants to get more distribution because it went for a D2C model hard during the pandemic and regretting it. And since then, basically, there's now a sort of like a shortage of shelf space because you've got on shoes and you've got hockey or wherever. There's a bunch of in America who basically have taken their shelf space. And so if you're a retailer and you've got big shoe manufacturers who make juicy profits off the back of these $400-$500 shoes, you know, basketball boots, then essentially you're in a good position. And I think they are to a certain extent. So yeah, I know, I'm with you.
And the balance sheet's fine. There's no issue with structural debt. You've got to remember to ignore the lease liabilities because on a lot of sort of data sites, that will show up as debt, which they have to present it that way because that's what the accounting standards say. But that's billions of debt that isn't debt. It's just future operating rental costs in future years. So manually take that out. The balance sheet's fine. There's no issue with debt at all.
Yeah. Big thanks to Lemmy Physical for putting a comment on the about Card Factory here, Paul. You're happy to hear this one. Apparently, Card, according to Lemmy Physical, has become the sole supplier to Aldi in their supermarket. So, so that's obviously it'll be a positive for them, to say the least. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Just want to just tie a bow on some of these retailers. We've got one from Dragon from last week. We've got Sosanda, which is that the ladies' wear type online. Clothes and stuff, but now it's just dipping its toe into sort of like retail outlets, etc. But also I think it's sticking to full price, not doing as much discounting. Some of the revenues is not quite as strong as it used to be, the growth that is, but the margins are a bit higher. How do you see this one at all?
Well, I've lost interest in this. I bought some when it originally floated, and it was quite an exciting growth story back in the days when everyone thought online fashion retail was the way to go. Anyway, I mean, look, I'm neutral to slightly positive because half the market cap has come down a lot. The half the market cap is now its own net cash pile, so this thing is very well funded. It's not burning cash. A lot of people say, oh, it's just going to burn through the cash. It's not. Look at the numbers. Basically, you get landlord contributions often when you open physical stores. So they're not necessarily, to open physical stores doesn't necessarily cost as much as people think it does. They're only opening sort of boutique style stores in high end towns. Bath and Harrogate, I think, are the next. And they're basically, because they've got the online database, they know where all their customers live. So it's quite a clever, targeted way they're doing it. And they're saying that having a store there where they know their customers already are, that's quite an interesting way of doing it. I can't think of any retail business that started online and is then using their online data as a way of educating them into where to open physical stores. It's sort of the wrong way around, isn't it? They're very smart, the management there. It's actually profitable. They've confirmed in line, so it's going to make 1 million profit in March to 25. Even though revenues are down, gross margins are massively up to very, very high, 64-65%, which is sector leading. So it's still going, and it's only market cap's only about 17 million, half of which is net cash. So I think they're in with a chance, but the exciting upside, I think, has gone. I see this business surviving. Yeah. I think management are very talented, and I think it'll probably tick along, making one. They reckon they can get to 10 million PBT. I think that's just pie in the sky. I'm ignoring that. And they're opening a few more shops at a time. They've not given us any data on the shops. They just say, oh, they're trading well. But they always say that about everything. So without any numbers on how much the shops are actually making, which they can't tell us because it's commercially sensitive, but I don't think this is really going anywhere. So it's more of a value share now. But do you know Sosanda, Paul?
I know it a bit, but let's be clear about it. Ladies fashion is so tough to make inroads. You've got M&S, you've got NX, you've got a whole bunch of really strong brands, and it's a difficult one to actually get scale, particularly. I wish him all the best, to be perfectly honest, but it's an uphill struggle, that one.
It is an uphill struggle, you're right. And they are selling through M&S and NEX websites and doing very well, apparently, on those websites. But I think the end game for this is it probably ticks along for a few more years and then NEX buy it.
Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, we've got a question coming in from Patrick Leonard. He's basically asking what to do with FD Technologies. Now, that I know a bit about this. This is a technology business that's got two major divisions at the moment. One of them is a sort of a consultancy for sort of like real-time capital markets data to traders and to fund managers, and which they've just sold off. And then they've got this really high rapid KX Insights business that is real-time data software that is supplying a lot of the really sort of like the high-speed frequency traders with information data, but also going to other commercial areas. And he's asking, they're doing a tender offer of £19.50, I think it is, and what the prospects for the business to be left over. Don't know if you've ever had a look at this one, Paul.
I have. I'm just looking through my notes for it here. H1 results were in line, weren't they? 500 million market cap. I can't remember much about it, though, Paul. So I'm going to pass on this one rather than make up something.
Yeah. All I would say, Patrick, is if the tender offer is £19.50 or £19.25, which is about the share price now, personally, I would put all my shares into the tender offer. If I own them, I'd tender the whole lot. Obviously, they're only going to take a percentage of them, say 20%, 25%, because everybody's going to do the same. Because on the anticipation that the shares will drop immediately after the tender offer is settled. And if you want to buy the shares that you've just sold in the tender offer at £19.50, you'll be able to buy them at a lower level. This always seems to happen. It happened with Whitbread about 2 or 3 years ago. They did exactly the same. It also occurred with NIOX just recently in the small cap sector. So I'd be very surprised if the share price increased immediately after the tender offer. When it comes to sort of your KX Insights part of the business, given it's now just a single entity, I suggest that's going to be a bit of a takeover target for American. So I would monetize some of it and then decide whether you want to sell a lot in the market or afterwards, or basically hold on. But it's an interesting one. It's a sum of the parts special situation.
I have looked at this before, but I just can't remember anything about it. So yeah.
Okay, let's go.
With all these things, every situation is unique, isn't it? So people have just got to really make their own decision and do what they hope is best.
Yeah. Another one which came out with a trading update, which wasn't that positive, was Everyman Media, which do these sort of like comforting high quality cinemas and provide hospitality to people. And I think what they said, the film slate wasn't quite what they were expecting in the reaction in Christmas, and they've cut their forecast for this current year and next year, I think. What's your sort of your take on Everyman?
I've been absolutely brutal about this one today.
Oh, I see.
Today's report. It was a profit.
Don't hold back then, Paul.
I don't. No. I'm very critical about this company because it doesn't have a viable business model. It's as simple as that. And yet they trump. So here we are. Profit warning was out this morning. That's what I'm calling it. They didn't call it that. But their trumpet that EBITDA, this is for calendar 2024, was flat at 16 million, flat against last year, despite revenue being up 18%. So they're opening these fancy cinemas, which cost a bomb, cost millions to fit out, and it doesn't make any money from them. It's a ludicrous business model. It's not a viable business model. And this £16 million EBITDA, if you look at the broker research this morning, I forget which broker it is, might have been Zeus, so thank you to whichever broker it was, that translates that £16 million EBITDA into a £5 million pre-tax loss. And that's not because of any exceptionals. It's because there's a whacking great depreciation charge, of course. And you can't just ignore depreciation, because that is the annual charge for the estimated lifespan of all the fixed assets. So to ignore it is absolute madness, because people coming into a cinema every day are trashing the sofas and the carpets and everything. It all has to be replaced. And that's why you need to account for that with depreciation charges. The finance charge is enormous as well, because, of course, I'm pretty sure they quote the old the modern EBITDA number under IFRS 16, which understates things, because it doesn't include all the rental costs, a lot of which goes through the finance costs line. So ignore EBITDA for this particular company and quite a few other companies. It could be highly misleading with some. I know it has its place in some sectors, but definitely with this one it isn't. So this is a loss-making company, £5 million loss for 2024, that's rolling out a format that doesn't make any money. It's madness. And then the outlook, they've said they're, quote, more cautious for 2025 and 2026 as well. A load of nonsense about, it was family films, so we didn't sell as much food. Just excuse after excuse. The Hollywood strikes are still affecting the bottom line is these cinemas don't make any profit. So Everyman, from me.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think you made a really good point, actually. When you look at EBITDA, you need to have a readjusted EBITDA on these ones, because if you take the published adjusted EBITDA, you then need to deduct all the rent rate, you know, the rental rolls and the rent, you know, yeah, the cars which go into the actual cash payments, which go into interest payments as well.
Yeah, so that's right. And it's no good just looking at maintenance capex as well, because of course with these leases, if it doesn't make a profit, they just hand it back to the landlord and they don't take anything. Well, they'll probably take projectors and, you know, a few bits and pieces out, but the main capex cost is just written off when you hand the keys back to the landlord. So, you know, depreciation charges are there for a reason, and they're worked out very carefully. Each category of asset will have an estimated life, and it's madness to ignore depreciation charges, in my view. But that's fashionable at the moment, and it's leading, I think, some people to make big investing mistakes.
Yeah. Okay, in the same area, I chatted actually to Christopher Mills, who's obviously the rock star.
I know, I'm looking forward to it. I've downloaded that. I'm going to look at it, listen to it this evening. Yeah, what a guy.
I've listened to it twice already. He's brilliant. Okay, and one of the shares he owns is Facilities of ADF, which basically that sort of film industry, they do the sort of the very plush and sort of like sort of trailers and trucks and stuff, production kit, which goes to outside broadcasts and to outside filming. And they got they got hit by, obviously, the Hollywood strikes. Yeah. But they did actually, in October, I think it was sometime anyway, last year, they bought this auto track business, did a placing to raise £10 million at 50p, which I think Christopher was party to, knowing obviously that, you know, basically that we're at the end of the Hollywood writer strike. However, what he hadn't appreciated or hadn't been told was that there were still ramifications from that throughout. He saw that through Zoo, and he told me he was less than amused. Now, what's interesting for investors is that they did the placing at 50p. The shares are currently trading at 36, and his view, okay, it's a sound business, so he's definitely not selling, he said, but he's thinking about adding, which he rarely goes, buys down, and reading between the lines, and I really don't know, but given he's an active investor, I imagine he's working feverishly behind the behind the screen to get this management team in place to be able to change this business. And we know we've seen the sort of the Harwood magic in action before, and I mention it because it's looking really, really cheap for the, you know, it's one for the brave, but he's a very sensible, brave investor. I don't know what your thoughts on this one is.
Yeah, I've looked at this quite carefully. I remember ever since it listed, I thought it was one of the better IPOs at the time, but I think I've called on it. I did actually buy some immediately after the profit warning, about 32p, which is obviously you shouldn't normally do, and I think I sold them at or near the low at about a penny or two less than that. So again, ignore my trades, but I got cold feet on it, and I'll tell you why. Because I think there's a certain definitely a lack of trust now over that 50p placing, which was outrageous. Let's call a spade a spade. It was outrageous. And it's a pity, because the acquisition they made, the Metal Roadways thing for festivals and whatever, it's a fabulous little business, you know. I dug its accounts out of company's house. Tremendously profitable. And so it was a very good acquisition. But, you know, they should have... No, I won't say any more on that. It was just unforgivable that bombshell profit warning came out, you know, within just a few months of a fundraise. And also some of the insiders dumped a big load of stock in the placing as well. It wasn't just a primary placing, it was a secondary placing as well. So I feel it's not that good a business. I think it's an okay business, and it floated when, of course, the streaming boom was going on, which has now ended. So I don't think the recovery upside is maybe as strong as they're making out. And certainly looking at the broker consensus numbers for calendar 2025, those look pie in the sky to me. So I think this has got another profit warning written all over it, I think.
What would you change your view? What would you think the share price would do if they had a change in management and there was a very respected industry professional came on, you know, to basically take it over?
I don't know, Paul. I mean, all I can, I mean, it is asset backed. It's, you know, it's good. It owns, I think it owns some of them and leases some of them of these trailers and Winnebago things, but it's all about utilization. And they've had problems in the past as well. If you're doing some, you know, great long 6 or 12 month filming at Downton Abbey or something, you know, that's a great gig. And Amazon are paying for it and are not really that fussed about the cost. You know, and these guys are the only guys in town who got the right equipment, blah, blah, blah. That stuff is great. But they then found that it, when it gets a bit more bitty and it's smaller budget, shorter type productions, that downtime in between kills their overall results. So I don't think it's as good a business as we originally thought, I have to say.
Yeah. My money's on Christopher Mills. Right. Okay, let's move on. We've got a question from...
They don't get them all right, Paul.
No, they don't. No, you're right. We got another question. We got one from Ben Sharma. He's asking, house builders, are we at the bottom yet, Paul?
Yes, I've rung the bell. I stuck my neck out this week in my Substack. Obviously, it's slightly tongue-in-cheek, but I'm saying, yes, I think this is now the low point for house builder shares. And I haven't bought any yet myself, but I've got several on my... list of potential buys. I just haven't got any money at the moment and I don't want to sell anything else. So the reason why I'm saying I think this could be the low point in the house builder shares is that the trading updates from the large ones have all been pretty sound. Persimmon in particular, I think, is top of the draw. Their update for 24 was, I think, towards the top end of analyst range, and it's a wide range, so that is very impressive. And the outlook comments for these things are all good. All the house builders have put out positive. I looked at Gleeson today in a lot of detail for my premium readers, so people need to subscribe to have a look at that. But I think that's very good.
They do more affordable homes, don't they, Gleeson?
Gleeson is very much at the affordable end, which, if anything, is going to be probably helped more by government intervention, and that is trading below net tangible asset value, which is madness. Yes. Because if you this is net tangible assets at cost, remember, with you're paying less than a pound for a pound's worth of solid tangible assets that are actually worth more than book value. So the valuations don't make sense on some of these things. But meanwhile, you've got Vistry and Crest Nicholson, which have been nothing but trouble. So I'm saying, on similar valuations, so I'm actually changing my mind on those and thinking, well, why do you need to take the risk of getting involved with the problematic ones? Vistry's bounced 20% from the low. So I think that's probably best left alone now. I was going to buy some of those, but I missed the low and I'm not interested in paying 20% more. But I am interested in Taylor Wimpey in particular, because that, strangely enough, that was the only one that mentioned elevated build cost outlook, whereas actually Persimmon and Vistry said the opposite and said that build cost inflation is now largely gone, which must include wages as well as NI and products. They said it was low single digits. Both of them used that phrase, whereas Taylor Wimpey said elevate or something along the lines of elevated build costs. So it dipped 5%, but you're now getting Taylor Wimpey at well below net tangible asset value. I say well below, 10 or 12 discount. I think that's absolutely irresistible. So, and the other thing is, the broker forecasts have stopped falling. I think in the next few months you'll see brokers starting to edge up the forecast, because these guys are all saying the outlook for 2025 is better. So you want to, in my view, I want to get in a few months ahead of brokers starting to raise their forecasts. It won't be much, but they'll probably start. And they're always too cautious at the bottom of the cycle. They'll brokers say things like, oh, for now we're leaving our estimates unchanged because, you know, blah, 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 blah. That's your opportunity. That window of a few months where it's obvious that the forecasts are going to start rising because of what the companies are telling us. And, you know, the interest rate trajectory now appears to be getting back to where we hoped it might be. Yeah. There was a very good article in the Financial Mail saying that the Bank of England official, their senior economist, I said, was talking about 6 interest rate cuts, saying we need to stop the economy going into recession, which I thought was a massive change of tone. So those are the reasons I'm now ringing the bell and saying, I think this could never will, because I don't know the future. This could be a good time to be looking at these things. These house builders for potential buying opportunities. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, you're right on certainly on the interest rate side, because of the softer CPI. Now they're baking in like 2.5 cuts, I think, this year. They're almost dead certain we're going to get a interest rate cut next week by the Bank of England. So that should be all supportive for a forward. Yeah, should be all supportive. You're right. When it comes to valuations, less than, you know, one times tangible book or less than tangible book, it's a giveaway. Yeah. I guess the only thing about Taylor Wimpey, which does raise an eyebrow, is that why are they saying an increasing, you know, much higher build cost when all the others are saying a much, you know, low single digit? Yeah. Was there any reason for it at all?
No explanation for that. So I think it did. Yeah, we're all scratching our heads on this and saying, well, why? Yeah. So yeah, good point, Paul.
Yeah. I think my only take on it, because I used to own Taylor Wimpey a long time ago. Okay. Luckily I sold that at about there. So I was fortunate. But anyway, regardless, I know a bit about the company. And I think out of the industry, they've got the biggest provision for cladding and for fire safety and stuff like this. Okay. Now that's already been taken into net tangible assets. So we can discount that. But what that means for build costs going forward, okay, because they've got a 5-year land bank, yeah, or 6-year land bank, then they've basically bought that on the assumption that they were going to put in these, you know, sort of like 11 meter sort of story, or even 18 meters. So my only only guess why their build cost inflation is higher than others is that what they've built into their land bank for construction is by proportion, a higher proportion of new building that needs to have all of the new fire regulations and new all the sprinklers and stuff. And so because everybody's having to buy that equipment, that's where you're getting more price inflation than you are for bricks and for plasterboards and this sort of stuff. So I think it's just a mix effect, actually, which is hitting it. That's a great guess.
Thanks, Paul. I always learn something from chatting through shares with you because I'm just a generalist flitting about from 700 different stocks from one to another. So I don't have that depth of knowledge. So that's very useful. Thanks.
Yeah, but I would say, you know, out of the ones I think you can pick a mix to a certain extent. I'd probably go for Gleeson would be the one I would go for because I think they've got very small. But if you do go for house builders, I think, as you've rightly talked about many times before, the government could pull the windfall tax on, you know, we're building 300,000. Yes. You know, that's always a left field that who knows.
Yeah, it is. But I think that's now more than compensated for in the prices. It's all about share price for me. I don't inherently like or dislike any company or sector. I just look for where I think the share price is anomalous compared with what's probably going to happen. But as you say, there's always unknowns. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I've got one for the brave here. Okay.
It's Paul the Parrot.
He's got a few questions. SRT Marine. Now, is this has been a perennial disappointment for years and years and years. It came out with a trading update this week, was actually seen a significant increase in revenues and was profitable. Yes. And is talking about a massive order book, which it has done for many a time. But the shares have rallied significantly from their lows.
Yes.
So what's your view here?
Well, I don't want to spend really much time on this because you either believe the company's millions and billions order book stuff or you don't. And but the trading update was good. It was, you know, credit where credit's due. They indicated, I think, 25.5 million revenues. And this is for the first half only. And 2.5 million profits. It's the first time they've announced a profit in a while. But in the past, it's always been feast or famine, you know, sort of false dawns. They've got zero visibility. You know, they can have things in the pipeline. I think the pipeline is over $1 billion, supposedly. And, you know, these things can take 10 years or more to get signed. You know, I just think that lack of visibility makes this impossible to value. So for those reasons, I wish them well, but it's not for me.
Yeah. No, I mean, I would also say, okay, even if they do win all of these big contracts, they convert them from the order book into real sales. What happens when you've actually implemented them? You know, what's the? I know they have some recurring revenue streams, but you might find there's a huge hump for 2 years. You do really well, and the shares, you know, value off 2 years, but actually won't get the ongoing revenue. I really don't know. So no.
I think they've talked about maintenance support contracts. But, you know, when you look at what the low points are for revenue in the past, and that clearly shows that it's not very much.
Yeah.
maintenance and support. And they do talk about follow-on orders and, you know, phases for these projects and everything, but it's just been too lumpy in the past for me, I think. But, you know, you've got a lot of newer investors coming in who don't have that sort of jaundiced view of companies from having followed them for about 20 odd years. So maybe, you know, maybe me knowing the history of this company so well is means that I'm going to miss a multi-bagger. But
you're coloured about it.
Yeah, you can't swing at everything. It's like you say, I just want to pick things where I really can prove that the numbers, that risk reward is in my favour. This one is too much of a leap of faith and hoping that this happens and hoping that happens. Yeah. I don't want to do stuff like that, really.
No, you and I are similar in that respect. That's why we both missed Filtronic as well, when that really sort of took off, because we've been years and years waiting.
Yes, and it's had these feast and famine things in the past as well, Filtronic has, but that's going great, isn't it? Sorry to my premium subscribers, that was actually on one of my top lists for the current year. So, Filtronic, but it's made up and it's gone up nicely, but it's made up for I got hit by a profit warning on something else.
Oh well, we all get. I've got 20. I think I'm just flat. So yeah, like everybody else, you get.
Yeah, I'm flat. I'm flat so far. Yeah.
Okay, we've got a question coming in from Paul the Parrot. He's asking. There you can see the parrot. There we go. Phonics has drifted. This is basically a mobile phone sort of messaging and texting business. It does for charities and does phone-ins and stuff. Does for TVs. Anyway, it's drifted on news. They should have a trading statement out next week. Could see a bounce. Any views on Phonics?
Yeah, love it. It's a really good business, very good management. It seems to just do this, doesn't it? Every now and again when somebody wants to sell a few, it dips down to about £2 and whatever. And that's usually a good buying opportunity. Forward P's 19 times. I think that's fine. It's a good business. Forward, it pays out all its profits as divvies. So you've got a 4.3% dividend yield. Doesn't need any asset backing because it's just an IT business. Incredibly sticky customers. It's expanding in Ireland and Portugal, I think, and looking at other territories. I think it's very good. They do the voting, the telephone voting for TV shows, which seems to be very, very sticky. I don't think they've ever lost a client. So, yeah, I think it's really good. And, yeah, Paul the Parrot's right to say that it's dropped recently, and at £2.05, £2.06, I think that looks okay. Not compelling value, but looks a reasonably opportune moment to maybe pick up a few, possibly. I probably won't myself, as I say, because I'm going after the cheap house builders and things like that.
I would say if they can get that top line motoring, they've demonstrated they can make a lot of money and generate a hell of a lot of cash in the UK. They're obviously dipped the toe into Portugal, and they've got Ireland as well. If they make out, you know, if they can make repeat the exercise, then the shares will do really, really well.
I think they're very, very smart people there as well. I get the impression. And actually, if you look at the 5 or 6 year track record for the company, I think that's all organic growth. It's fabulous. You know, it's almost tripled revenues between 2019 and what will be 2026, and triple profits. Well, that is very good for a PE of 19. So it is good, I think, Phonics.
Yeah. Well, we've got a couple of people. We've got Grant and we have Trademark 72 asking about Galliford Try and also Costain, the contractors.
Yeah, I looked at Galliford Try this week, and the readers are probably sticking pins in an effigy of me because I just don't like it. I know the shares have done well, and people love it when shares go up, obviously. But if you look at the fundamentals of it, 1.7 billion revenue, 30 million profit. I mean, what's the point? Doing large, complex, risky projects. So I'm sorry, but it's only a matter of time before something goes wrong. I don't care what anybody says. And so for that reason, it just zero interest to me. And there's nothing on the balance sheet. Price of tangible book is 16 times. So that means you've only got about 25, 30 million net tangible asset value, but the market cap's over 400 million. And people say, it's got loads of cash. That's because it gets money up front from customers. So if revenues were to drop, if contracts were to dry up, all that cash would disappear. So I don't think this one is any good at all, I'm afraid. So But I appreciate that's an unpopular view. But I've just explained the reasons for it, so people have, can agree to disagree. But are you as
what about Costain as well? Is Costain in the same boat? I mean, they're obviously another contractor.
I can't remember looking at Costain recently, but that's got a much, much better balance sheet. It did a big fundraise during COVID, I recall, because it said at the time, we need a bulletproof balance sheet. That's dipped, hasn't it? £1.10 to about 95p recently. You're having a swig on your gin and tonic there, Paul?
Yeah, I started early. Sorry about that. It's a lot of Baileys, the whiskey.
Well, Costain, yes, I mean, similar sort of thing, very, very low margin. I think from what I remember, Costain, was this the one that was doing had quite an ambitious program to raise its operating margins?
And Galliford Try is exactly the same. They've both gone, yeah. They've both moved away from fixed price contracts to pass through margins, but big deals, and they're on a drive to improve their margins.
Fair enough. That's probably something I should have met. I didn't mention. So yeah, if they can drive through much higher margins, these things, and I think they're on sort of preferred supplier type setups now, aren't they? So yeah, that's the angle on them, isn't it? As I say, it doesn't appeal to me because you only need one contract to go badly wrong and you've suddenly got 20-30 million remediation costs. And, you know, the UK is uniquely bad, it seems, at doing big infrastructure projects. So why on earth would I want to buy businesses that eke out a tiny margin in those sectors?
Other than the share price has doubled.
Well, I know, but you know, it's a sword of Damocles with these type of shares. One of your interviewees said that, one of your fund managers said, the trouble is you buy into these things and you can go years and make good money on it, and then bang, you wake up one morning, huge contract's gone wrong, and it takes years for them to recover. I mean, look at, zoom out on the share price, Paul, and look at where it was in 2018.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, no, you're right. Isn't it?
You know, so not for me, but I don't want to come, you know, I'm not. That I don't have a particularly strong view on it, as you as you just heard, but there, it's just not, I wouldn't be seduced by the fact that the shares have done very, very well from lows. I mean, it's doubled from the recent lows, but it's still down more than three quarters, about 80% on where it was in 2018. So that's Costain. Galliford Try's probably similar. So no, just rubbish sector, I think.
Well, one of the interesting things, I mean, the UK is spending a shed load on infrastructure, you know, and one thing I hadn't appreciated, actually, according to Christopher Mills, we're building a massive, you know, couple of big reservoirs for the first time ever. And that's going to be like billions and billions, as well as adding on to, you know, basically the transport and, you know, energy transition and stuff. So it's quite, there aren't that many. Anyway, I mean, I'm with you. I wouldn't go into the contractors at all myself because of the danger you talk about. But having said that, they do have some secular tailwinds, no doubt about it.
Yeah, no, fair point. And also, just to correct one mistake, I was referring to Costain's chart before being 80% down. I've just checked Galliford Try, and actually, that's the complete opposite. The Galliford Try, as you zoom out on the chart, has been extremely impressive, and not just in the last 2 or 3 years. You know, if you go back to the great financial crisis lows, it was about 20p, and it's now 20 back since then. So we've probably had a whole bunch of viewers screaming at their laptop, swearing and saying, "You idiot, you're talking rubbish, Scott." So I just want to correct that point. Galliford Try shares have done very well long term as well as short term. I still wouldn't buy any.
Yeah. Okay, let's move to a fallen angel, which is actually a bit of a star recently, is Eagle Eye Solutions, which is basically a software for sort of like vouchers and for discounts and for pricing and this sort of stuff to large multiple supermarkets. I've got even suspicion that Tesco's might be using it in their club card in certain places, but it hasn't put a foot wrong until last week when it had a revenue warning, even though the profits were okay. Shares dropped about 20%. Is this an opportunity, or is this still something we should treat relatively carefully?
I don't know at the moment. I was, as with most people, I was very, very, as with you, I'm very, very surprised this warned on profits, because it hasn't been a foot wrong. It's been quite a recurring revenue type business, or at least recurring and repeating revenue. Big supermarkets mainly use it, Asda's use it for their innovative version of Clubcard, but it's personalized. The offers are personalized. It uses all the buzzwords, you know, of AI, and it's genuine. It does use algorithms which learn off each other. Very nice business, I think. So yeah, it has blotted its copybook. Directors have bought some shares, but not really enough to make that much difference. The CFO, I think, but spent 50 grand, which, you know, CFOs are pretty cautious, aren't they? They're not usually that rich. So I thought that was encouraging. But yeah, I think this one, I want a bit more time to think about it. Yeah, they didn't really give a particularly clear reason why they've missed their targets. And I think the forecasts were reduced, the profit forecasts. It wasn't just revenue. I think
housebroker. Yeah, they did. They not as much as the revenue, but you're right. The profit came down. Yeah.
So it's blotted its copybook. There's no doubt about it. I think they said that revenue and profit in H1 would be flat. But yeah, here we are. The brokers have cut the forecast profits for this year and next year by roughly 10-15%, 15%-ish. So I think we need more answers. Why has that happened? Is it going to run out of money? No, it's okay for cash. But yeah, it's definitely blotted its copybook, hasn't it? So I think we need more clarity on what's gone wrong. Maybe I should ask the CEO to do a podcast with me, because I've spoken to him a couple of times. I think he gives nice straight answers to straight questions, you know. So I think I'm leaning towards saying I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, but I'm a little bit wary now.
Yeah, no, so am I. I would add, the reason I think that they gave for the actual revenue warning was this elongated sales cycles, i.e. people, you know, their customers deferring it. Now, okay, that explains it one way, but why are they delaying it? Is that because of extra competition, or is it because they're selling in the retail, which is a tough space at the moment? And if it is, what's going to change it? Even though you'd have thought vouchers and discounts would be beneficial in an environment where people are cost conscious, because it will trigger people to buy. So you're right. I mean, I think
it is a complex thing to sell and set up, and that's probably one of the bear points on the stock. You know, the implementation of once they win a contract is a good 6 months, I think. And I don't buy this elongated sales cycle thing. You hear that all the time from companies. Yeah. They're just not selling as much as they thought they were going to sell. Ultimately, I'm very simplistic when I look at it that way. And often a client deferring something means that actually they're too polite to say they're not going to buy it.
Yeah. Good. Okay, we've got a question in the fund manager area from David Raywood. He's basically asking about, first of all, there's one in terms of specifically Sabre Capital. He's basically rattling the cage of many of the investment trusts. Any thoughts on that? And then let's talk about more broadly just the fund managers, because they are extremely cheap.
Yes, they are. Yeah, I've looked at a few of these now, because my former colleague Graham Neary, of course, used to cover all the fund manager stocks, and I didn't look at them, so I'm having to sort of learn the ropes on those. And I think it's actually the big problem is the outflows, obviously, because investors are just saying, look, I could have made 40% last year on the S&P. Why am I paying this active fund manager to faff around and make pretty much nothing or very little, selecting stocks that he's meant to be, where he's meant to be an expert? And okay, look, that happens some years, doesn't it, that the S&P will just go on a tear. But, you know, people are just going to take the money out. So some of these fund managers are losing 3-5% per quarter. And I can't see any reason why that would slow down if their funds, as you often see, are Q3 or Q4 quartile in performance. You know, the financial advisor is going to say, well, look, I would pull your money out of this. So I think it's just more of the same. I think it's a downward spiral. So I'd be looking for ones, and I am looking for ones, where they're saying assets under management is actually going up. And there was one this morning called N91, which said that, but they didn't give any detail at all, just a single number.
That's helpful.
So we don't know if Yeah, which of course then they can just add on, do bolt-ons of some other funds, put them on, and assets under management goes up, even though they're hemorrhaging outflows in the other funds. So, you know, they've got to give you the proper information.
Yeah. Another one which had inflows, which is unusual, is Polar Capital. Which is
I can't remember if I looked at that one, but yes, they, I did. They, that one was quite good. Yeah, I did look.
They're on about 10 times PE, and they've got about a 9% dividend yield, which Christopher Mills reckons is absolutely sustainable because they've got a really good balance sheet. And the reason why their AUM is increasing is because they're heavy into US tech, life sciences, and the other stocks out in America, so they're dollar heavy as well. So if they get a sterling weakness, then they'll make more on their performance fees as well. That's his choice anyway out of the fund managers.
Well, I looked at that. Funnily enough, I've just been Googling. You just found my report. Yeah. I wrote about this on Monday in my Substack, and I agree. You know, not that it matters what I think compared with the esteemed Christopher Mills.
Christopher Mills.
Yeah. I was positive on it as well. I reviewed the asset under management update, and AUM went up 9% since March 24. And as you say, all these things are on a PE of 10 and got 8% yields, pretty much. So it's all about, and they did particularly well on performance fees, didn't they? Oh, no, that was flat or slightly down.
No, it was. No, they had a big payment on performance fees, about 9 million or something.
That's right. But it mainly related to one fund. So I do think you've got to bear in mind with these things that some of the ones that are apparently doing well, it is kind of a bit one-offish. But I think, very nice balance sheet, net tangible assets, 116 million. They've all got good balance sheets. I looked at the H1 results and they were good. So I think Polar is one of the top picks from the sector, definitely.
Yeah, and I think you're right. If you sort of like decide which ones out of the very selective on the fund managers, and you go for the inflows. I mean, money follows money, and in the investment trust basis, the two in the small cap sector that have done very well and raised money at premiums to net tangible book are Rockwood Strategic, which is Richard Staveley's one, and Onward Opportunities, which is Lawrence Hall's one. Both of them have delivered 20-30% returns last year, and it attracts money. So if you're a fund manager, active, and you're delivering above performance, then you will attract inflows. So it's sort of like the acid test, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And I think the whole industry is under severe stress at the moment because it's becoming quite obvious that a lot of these managed funds are just no good. They're not they're not particularly well managed. And why should people pay 0.86% per annum management fee when you've got somebody running it who's not making anywhere near as much money as you could in a passive tracker? So this industry is in a real pickle, I think. And as you say, the best ones, I think, are the smallest ones with the really genuinely brilliant managers like Richard Staveley. And he's only got a small fund. And also, what was the other one I liked? There was another one that was knocking the ball out of the park, but I can't remember.
Onward Opportunities.
Onward Opportunities, is it? No, I haven't looked at that one, actually. Sorry. Yeah. I tell you, one of the other fund managers I think is worth a look, and I don't have shares in any of these personally, is Premier Miton. Yeah. That put out a recent update. Now, they are small and nimble, and most of their money is in funds that are actually doing okay, and they're sufficiently small that they can start up new funds in hot areas, and it moves the dial. Whereas you look at something like Lion Trust, most of their assets under management are in stagnant, quite large funds that are performing disastrously badly. So I think, if you value these things on a market cap of 1% of their assets under management, which is currently what Lion Trust is valued at, the assets under management are going to probably drop 20% each year compound. So the shares will drop 20%. So getting a 15% dividend yield, I think, is an illusion. It might compensate you in the short term for the shares going down, but they need to completely reinvent themselves somehow to attract money. And that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, how do you think that can be done, Paul?
As you say, it just comes down to performance. There's two ways of attracting money. First of all, you're going to basically see an unwinding of this passive tracker type stuff that basically then moves back into active as we get a moment of truth in the passives. And I think that will happen at some point. But what's the catalyst? Yeah. There'll be a Bitcoin going bust or something, you know, breaking up. And then the other way of doing it is actually just really excellent performance on your returns. You like your Staveleys and your Lawrence Hallses of this world, because they've been raising money at net tangible assets or a premium to it because people want to put the money in. So those are the two ways.
And arguably, these things are marketing organizations, aren't they? They start up a scattergun approach with all these different funds, close the ones that don't work. Survivorship bias then gives you outperformance. Everyone's Q1, aren't they? Because you close the ones that are Q4. And then rinse and repeat, come up with a fund on quantum computing or crypto or whatever, attract some money in, pay yourselves lots of money. And, you know, they're quite flaky business models, actually, I would say, in this sector.
Yeah, well, maybe you should start up your own fund, Scotty Situations, or something like that. Oh, that'd be perfect.
No chance.
We'd meet down the Mary Shelley. Not. What about that? Okay, just to close, we'll just run through. There's a couple of that Christopher Mills highlighted, because it's worth doing that for investors, because I asked him right at the end, what's his favourite stock for 2025?
Now, spoiler alert, I haven't listened yet, but I'll let you go.
Spire Healthcare, okay? And the reason is, we talked about it briefly, but the reason is it's the number one UK, you know, private hospital provider. It's got about 40 hospitals. It's got increasing demand because it's got obviously there's a waiting list for NHS surgeries of 7.5 million. And the Labour are committed to getting that down. They've got a contract with the NHS to do it, and it looks as though they'll have all the NI associated with the NHS contracts will be passed through to the NHS. So that's going to protect their margins. They've got their ongoing efficiency drive in terms of improving the productivity per space in these hospitals. So they're doing less cosmetics, they're doing more hips and knee surgeries. And then the underlying business is doing well, and he reckons over the next 2 to 3 years that the EPS will go from 10p to 20p. Okay, will double exactly. Yes. Yeah. Now, what's really interesting, he does the sum of the parts on it with there, because they own a lot of the properties and stuff, and he sees another 100% upside. Where there's that, yeah, that, okay, yeah. That's obviously good. However, there could also be a near-term catalyst, and this is really interesting, which I hadn't appreciated. You highlighted last time we spoke to them, they've got this 30% shareholder, MediClinic International. I think they're in the Middle East. Anyway, they apparently want to sell, okay? And apparently an Indian or an Asian hospital provider has approached them. In terms of just very indicatively, and it might well be that marriage happens, and if it does, it will be a lot higher than this. So his number one pick, which I highlight, I don't own it. My father actually owns Spire Healthcare. He just follows Christopher Mills. But for a low risk, with underlying fundamentally, the business will do well over the next 2 to 3 years, should do higher demand, you've got control over your cost, and you're more efficient, so you make more margins. And on top, you may have a potential, you know, transaction. So I don't know what your thoughts on Spire at all, Paul.
I've just been reviewing the numbers while you've been talking. I think this looks really interesting. Yeah. I was expecting to. I mean, healthcare is not really my sector at all, but I can look at the numbers and desktop view. Yeah, forward PE 16.2, tiny dividends, only 1.7% dividend yield, but that's okay. It's probably reinvesting. Price to tangible book is 3.2 times, which means there's good solid asset backing under there. And as you say, it's obvious, isn't it? The government's going to want to pay private providers to get help. I think that looks a very interesting stock idea. Yeah, I like it.
No, I haven't bought any, but it gets my thumb up there. That's for sure. My thumbs up. Yeah, okay.
And what a funny share price. It just goes sideways and wiggling a bit.
Yeah. No, I mean, as I say, it'll be really interesting if somebody bids for them, but we'll wait and see. Yeah. Nothing certain.
I think that looks very good. Yeah, very good.
And then the final one he's been buying is PayPoint, which was surprising to me.
Oh, yes.
It trades at about 10 times PE. I think it pays a 5% dividend yield. And what were the investment thesis he was saying was that their actual, because they do these ATMs in convenience stores, you know, to for cash handling, and they also now have added on, and they've also added on sort of like parcel collection and drop off points for online deliveries. And the reason why the latter in particular is flying is because I've had a lot of closures, obviously, for places like you know, the post offices. So and they're not set up to do it. So that business is doing really well. The margins are doing excellently. And what's quite interesting, which I hadn't appreciated out the cash side of it, the ATM side, is that because the banks are not only closing branches, they're also closing a lot of ATMs. And so consequently, if you want cash, which actually has been increasing recently, amazingly enough, in circulation, if you want cash, these could be the last man standing supplying it. So it was, they do seem to have, you'd think it'd be in a structural decline in the industry, but actually they have good growth. And the management team apparently have told him that, you know, over the next 3 to years, they're hoping to double the share price in the next 3 years. So he's been adding to his position. I don't know what your thoughts on PayPoint, but 10 times PE, there's not much good news priced in.
No, but it used to be a lot cheaper. I liked it when it was on a PE of about 7. I could see the value there. But it has re-rated quite a lot this year, or last year rather. Yeah. So personally, I wouldn't be chasing it at this level, because the core business that makes most of the money, I'm pretty sure that's right, is the legacy electric and gas card meter thing, which of course, you know, is gonna be overtaken, isn't it, by apps on people's phones and things like that. So all these supplementary things it's doing is all very well, but you know, you've still got, so you've got a legacy cash generative business that they're using to pay divvies, do buybacks and make acquisitions. To me, it's a bit of a scattergun approach. And I want to see a bit more time to see if these acquisitions have really worked. I think they bought the, didn't they buy the, what do you call it? The,
Appreciate.
Yeah, they bought that, which I thought was an okay business, not particularly exciting. And they bought a few other things, and they got some banking thing that, you know, one of these proliferation of sort of alternative banking type things that's going to be huge and all that sort of thing. So I don't know. I'm not that keen on it, if I'm on it. Now, I think it's okay, but I wouldn't pay £7 for it. Forward PE 9.3 is good value. Dividend yield 5.6%, very attractive, but no tangible asset value at all. It's negative. So can't get excited about that one, I'm afraid. So I'll probably be wrong.
I think private equity could take these out and split it up and then load it up with debt. But
would they want to though? Why would they want a legacy business for people paying their electric meters? I don't, you know, you've got to focus on where the profit's coming from, not the blue sky stuff, in my opinion, but I could be wrong.
Well, there must be some rationale for the management to say they're going to grow the business going forward. But anyway, you're right.
True. That's just an aspiration, though, isn't it? I tend to take those with a pinch of salt.
You don't do sort of like aspirational hopes to Christopher Mills. He'll nail you. Sorry. Doesn't get away with it. Okay, guys, we've obviously gone over our time. So
yeah, we've got to stop, haven't we? Yeah,
we'll stop that. But really, thanks for all your questions. Again, brilliant commentary, Paul. And look forward in touching base next week after another very busy 7 days coming up.
I know. I'm thinking of breaking dry January. I might give myself a free pass tonight. I think.
Make sure you hit the Mary Shelley for a few stellars.
Yeah, I think I will.
Thanks a lot, guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Paul. Really enjoyed it, as always.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.